Game On 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You are most welcome to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday's Game On. I didn't even need you to help me, Alan Colley. Busy evening in the Champions League. We have PSG against Barcelona. The game is live on RTÉ2 television shortly. Ray Houghton will be alongside George Hamilton for commentary. We will hear Ray's views ahead of the game in a couple of minutes' time. The other game tonight is Porto against Bayern Munich. So plenty to look forward to, plenty to reflect upon in terms of last night's game. So we will look forward to that with great interest. Jurgen Klopp has surprised quite a lot of people by bidding adieu to Borussia Dortmund at the end of the season, contracted until 2018, but he will pack his bags and head off into the sunset. A lot of English clubs, one in particular in Manchester, who wear a certain shade of blue, might be particularly interested in that. Dominic McGuinness will join us. We're going to have a fair bit of rugby as we start our build-up to Leinster against Toulon in the European Rugby Champions Cup this weekend, including former England international Tom May on his spell in Toulon and where Leinster can get the French champions this weekend. And is the scrum the problem child of the modern game? We will discuss that with Peter Bracken and Shane Byrne later in the programme. Former Jordan Formula One driver Ralph Furman on the ongoing spat between Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg at Mercedes, and much, much more to come. Mr. Colley, good evening to you.
Good evening, Mr. O'Mara. How are you?
I'm well and myself. Are you?
Flying it.
Good, good.
Yep.
Did you enjoy last night's games?
I actually did. Well, I only watched Madrid now. I didn't watch it, obviously. You can only watch one, I suppose.
How about you could record one?
No.
No, you're not into that, are you not?
No, well, I always fancied Juventus, to be fair.
Well, the record at home.
Yeah, and I think Arsenal missed the trick against Monaco. They should have beaten them, really. So, like probably most people, I watched the Madrid game. And it was really good. For a nil-all draw, it was really good.
Mm. And I suppose that we can talk loads about the balance of power later on. But you look at it, in terms of games to look forward to, PSG against Barcelona, tonight's one to savour.
I was just thinking about that on the way over. It doesn't get any better. Technically, Damien, this is as good as it gets with these two teams. We obviously seen PSG in the last round against Chelsea dominating them in the two games, even when they went down to 10 men at Stamford Bridge. Players like Verratti and Thiago Mota and Cavani, they're just an unbelievable array of players. But Barca, who were my favourites, who I love to watch every week, and they're just playing unbelievable football at the moment, and obviously Messi in the form that he's in, it's hard to look past them, it really is. But I think the game itself will be unbelievable.
No Mota tonight.
I've seen that, yeah. I was disappointed to see that because I thought PSG would definitely put it up to them.
Yeah, he's injured.
But with Ibrahimovic out and obviously Mata as well, I think it'll be tough for them.
Okay, well, let's get the views of Ray Houghton. As mentioned, the game is live on RTÉ2 television shortly. It takes place at the Parc de Princes. Ray will be alongside George Hamilton for coverage of the game. Spoke to him just before we came on air. We talked about the fact that this is the third meeting of the sides this year. They've played out two belters, 3-1 and 3-2. So should we expect much more of the same this evening?
Well, it may be a 0-0 tonight, because we've had a 3-2 game here in September, which Paris won. And then in the second match, you've seen with Suarez in the team, you had Neymar, you had Messi, all of them scored on the night after going a goal behind when Ibrahimovic opened the scoring for Paris Saint-Germain, and it ended up 3-1 to Barcelona. But anything could happen with the suspensions. Obviously, that could weaken Paris tonight, you know, with the likes of Ibrahimovic being out for the one game. Also, Verratti in midfield, I think he's going to be a big loss as well. And there's one or two injury doubts, you know, the likes of David Luiz has been out for some time. Thiago Motta, we'll talk about him not being involved tonight either. And I think they could be big losses, and it could be a huge incentive for Barcelona to take a lead into that second leg.
All in, Leonardo a couple of years ago talked about the Champions League being the level that Paris Saint-Germain wanted to be based upon. They've not made it to a semi-final since 1995. You look at the current squad, do you see the potential to win this year's tournament if they had all their players fit and raring to go?
I tell you what, they've been unlucky though, haven't they? You know, they've lost out in the quarterfinals the last two seasons, and it's been on goal difference. 2 years ago to Barcelona, last season to Chelsea, so they haven't been too far away. But I just feel that the fact that they haven't got their strongest 11 out here tonight could be pivotal. They're going to have to change their tactics tonight. It could be a lot more defensive. They might try and stifle Barcelona and keep it to 0-0 as best they can. And then hopefully in that second leg, you know, if they can get that one goal, it would mean Barcelona would need two, because 1-1 wouldn't be good enough. They would go through in the away goal. So, yeah, it's going to be tactically different tonight. I don't think it's going to be as open as the two qualifying games that we've seen. But certainly both teams have got match winners. You know, we think Pastore is going to be in the team tonight. Cavani, who's been playing on the left when Ibrahimovic plays, is going to play in a more central role tonight, and I think that's a position he prefers. He likes that license to roam from the centre to the right, to the left, you know, to make runs in behind the back four of the opposition. He's their top goal scorer in the Champions League this season with 6 goals. And when they won here 3-2 PSG, it was without Ibrahimovic. He wasn't in the side. So they have proven this season that they're not a one-man team, that they can do it with other players in the side, but he has been the talisman here for the last few seasons.
But if we were to reflect upon the earlier games this season, they took place at the time that the world was being led to believe that Barcelona wasn't a particularly happy camp. Messi coming out earlier this week to talk about how happy he is, happier than he's ever been at the club, and you know, it looks a steady ship again. So are PSG getting Barca at the wrong time?
Probably, yeah. I would suggest that. Although, you know, they drew 2-2 at the weekend against Sevilla when they were 2-0 up away from home. And they gave away a goal in the last few minutes when Piqué tried to play a ball out from the back and it was intercepted in the midfield area, and they went through to score to make it 2-2, and they can't afford to make mistakes like that in games like this. You know, this is where you really have to be rock solid as a back four, and I'm not sure Barcelona are. We've talked about it many times, a weakness in the side is that area of the field. Dani Alves is out suspended tonight, so we'll have to wait and see who gets the nod as far as the right back's concerned. I think that could be an interesting call, because they could be up against Pastore over on that side, and he's a very tricky, intelligent footballer who's, you know, got a lot of skill about him. He's quite quick and he can get to the byline, get crosses into the box. So I think it could be a fascinating game tonight, and it will be over the two legs. But Barcelona's form, apart from that draw, has been brilliant, and the three lads up front have been unstoppable. You know, the goals they scored recently have been terrific.
And that's it. You look at it, Suarez, you know, three of their last four Champions League goals. I think Messi has scored 6 goals away from home in the Champions League so far this season. So if you look at the possibility that PSG are vulnerable with the players they're missing, even if Barca are vulnerable defensively, they've got goals aplenty to possibly gain the upper hand tonight.
Yeah, and if you just have to look at the last two matches in the Champions League against Manchester City, you know, they went to the Etihad and completely played City off the park and really should have won it convincingly. I mean, the tie should have been over with in the first leg. They were that good and that much better than City, and even in the second game created lots of chances that they didn't take. Joe Hart had one of them nights that you dream about. He was a goalkeeper in the Nou Camp, the saves that he made. So yeah, there's no doubt going forward Barcelona can create goals, but is the front three? Because if you look elsewhere, you like seeing Iniesta's not scored a Champions League goal, Busquets doesn't score, you know, Rakitic has got one, so they are really dependent upon the three strikers really to get the goals in the games for them. But they are a formidable three. You just look at the goals that they've scored this season, it's been absolutely fantastic. Messi's the leader of the three of them, but Suarez is the one that's made the difference, because when you look at Neymar and Messi, they want to come short to get involved in the build-up play, whereas Suarez stretches the opposition's back four. He runs the channels. He's the one that wants to run in behind, you know, to give options for the midfield players. It isn't always into your feet all the time, so that you can actually make the defenders go back into positions where then your two wider players come in and get in possession of the ball, and then they can use their trickery to get at the back four. So it's a good blend. It's been working well. And there's no doubt they'll really fancy it tonight, Damien, because here in the stadium, the pitch is as good as you're going to get. It is absolutely stunning. First time I've been here to the stadium, and I'm just looking around and it's absolutely stunning. Great stadium. Is going to be a fantastic noise in here tonight, and the players couldn't want for a better pitch. It's absolutely brilliant.
One question on Suarez. There was a stat doing the rounds before the Newcastle-Liverpool game that Liverpool 34 goals down on where they were at this time last year. Now, you can put some of that down to the absence of Suarez, or, you know, we can debate how much of that is down to him being gone. Has it surprised you how quickly he's settled into Barcelona and maybe how integral he has come so quickly?
No, you're doing top class players, world-class players, they find it very easy and very accommodating, you know, to play in a system and a team where they've got, you know, when you've got Messi and Neymar supplying you with your opportunities, you're going to score goals. And I think it was just a matter of time. Remember, this lad was out, you know, until October. He couldn't play football anywhere, you know, so it was a real struggle for him, and it's going to take time for him to get match fit and really get up to speed with the other players. But once he has, it's been the dream team, isn't it? You know, them three, you know, they've virtually played every game. They know instinctively where each other are. They enjoy being in each other's company, and I think that's shown when they play. That's very much reflected that way, and that's why Barcelona are top of the league, and why they're probably favourites or thereabouts to win the Champions League this season as well.
Oh, you've taken the words out of my mouth. Would you have them? They're your favourites. We obviously saw the two Madrids last night. We'll see Bayern tonight. Barca for you, the team to beat?
Well, I mean, you would never rule out Bayern Munich, would you? You know, they're a formidable side. And they've got their own you know, trio up front who score goals. You know, Robin's been in good form. You've got Lewandowski. You've got Thomas Müller who can play in that position as well. And, you know, these are, you know, players that have been in World Cup finals as well. So, you know, I would never rule them out, and I wouldn't rule out Real Madrid either. But even after last night, you know, the 0-0, who's the advantage to going into that second leg? You know, because Real Madrid know Atletico get one goal. They need two. And they've got the ability to get the two goals. Don't get me wrong there. But there was a few signs defensively last night where it would worry against better opposition. And I think Barcelona, if they were to come up against Real Madrid over two legs, I think I would just go with Barcelona.
I tell you what, Ray, we'll leave it there. Plenty to look forward to tonight. It's live on RTE2 television. You'll be alongside George for coverage of the game from 7:45. Thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Damien.
Ray Houghton chatting to us a short time ago. That Champions League music in the background gets me every time.
It's nothing like it.
No. Right, so he's going for Barca. You going for Barca?
I am looking at the team sheets, yeah.
Do you want to run us through the teams?
Well, Barcelona is kind of the team picks itself at this stage, although Montoya instead of Alves at the back, Piqué, midfielder, Rakitic, Iniesta, Busquets. I think that's because that's Luis Enrique's favourite three. Xavi is kind of more of a bit power player now. And then obviously the three messiahs up front, Messi, Suarez and Neymar. But just looking at the Paris Saint-Germain team, Damien, yeah, they've no Verratti, they've no Mata, Marquinhos comes in, Johan Cabaye will play midfield, Pastore will play up front with Cavani and Lavezzi, and Rabiot comes into midfield. Yeah, looking at the team sheets, I'd have to fancy Barcelona, even though they're away from home, but I'd still fancy them.
Okay, and probably the smart money is on Bayern to do a job on Porto in the other game.
Oh, Bayern will win that, yeah.
Right, we're going to chat about somewhat of a surprise in German football earlier. A fairly hastily convened Borussia Dortmund press conference was the setting as Jurgen Klopp revealed that he has asked the club to terminate his contract this summer. There's 3 years still remaining on it. You would imagine that quite a number of clubs could be on red alert, especially Manchester City. The man has quite a unique take on his philosophy of football. Here he is chatting a couple of years back.
I watched so many matches in my life. Unbelievable. And they're really not so... there are some boring games. And then I sleep. And it's so boring. I think, oh, why they meet each other and make this 20, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 people in a stadium and it's boring game. It's not okay. So that's what we want to see. We want to enjoy our own game. Tactical things are so important. You cannot win without tactical things, but the emotion makes the difference. There are not so many clubs which can offer better things than we can do. The whole package, you see this. You see the football, you see the team, the coach is not so bad and all these things. It's a really good package. Yeah? But, of course, there are some clubs who are a little bit more sexy than us. I'm sure I'm not Alex Ferguson of Borussia Dortmund. I don't want to sit on the bench when I'm 69 or things like this here. I don't know if I can say I want to work in Premier League because it's no wish list. So we have to see. I don't have time for this, but of course in the future, I don't know. I love football, and maybe sometime Borussia Dortmund say, though it was a great time, but thank you very much. And yes, we both have to look for something else. Maybe this will happen, but for the only thing I can say, I don't think about anything else in this moment.
That's what he's had to say to the BBC a couple of years back. One of the quotes today, it's not that I'm tired, I've not had contact with another club, but I don't plan to take a sabbatical. Dominic McGuinness joins us from Manchester. Dominic, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks Damien, you well?
I'm not too bad at all. Would you expect Mr. Klopp to be one of your near neighbours come the start of the Premier League season next year?
Well, it's certainly got people's attention in Manchester. There's no doubt about that. Obviously, Pellegrini coming under a bit of heat, as he has done for a while, because obviously 8 defeats in this calendar year, it's not exactly the form of champions, is it? And with now an elite coach seemingly being available, and that's been the big point, because people have been talking about Manuel Pellegrini, and you know, he's now 2 years into a 3-year contract at the end of this season. He was, you know, never considered to be a serious long-term appointment, but you know, would he be leaving a year early? Many would say, well, probably yeah, but who would come in? Patrick Vieira has been lurking in the academy, of course. This is a guy that obviously has serious ambitions of his own, whether or not he's experienced enough or ready to take on the challenge of Manchester City. So then you look at a fella that has won 2 Bundesliga titles with a slightly unfashionable side and been within a whisker of a Champions League title, and again then obviously people put two and two together and think, well, there's a fit maybe. And he's obviously, you know, he has performed in Manchester as well, if that's the right phrase. 2012-2013 season, his Dortmund side played Manchester City off the Etihad pitch. They were absolutely fantastic. Somehow City managed to nick a draw with a very late Mario Balotelli, believe it or not, penalty at the end of that one. But, you know, they were magnificent. And just hearing that clip there in terms of him talking about the way that his teams play and the style of football, he would certainly bring a different level, I suppose, of excitement to any kind of team he took hold of. If, and it's all a big if, obviously, at this stage, he was to be a man for the future for Manchester City.
Well, let's address that if, because we have to be aware, and out of respect for Manuel Pellegrini, we are talking about a man's job who has a man still in it. Manchester City, it would appear to me from this distance, off the record and all the back channel stuff that goes on, they haven't been quick to come out and defend Pellegrini, or they don't appear from here to have been quick to come out and try and justify the fact that he'll be there next season. So is it almost accepted within the Manchester football scene that he will be on his bike in the summer?
Well, for a start, if you talk to supporters, I mean, there are many that are saying, hang on a second, this is a guy that is still, you know, the manager that has the title-winning side. Although, you know, Chelsea are going to romp it this year, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, Manchester City won the league last year, and he won the League Cup as well. So two trophies in his first season in England. I mean, that is good going by anyone's standing. You know, whatever was going on with other teams maybe not performing or whatever, he did the business in terms of two trophies. Now, this is his second season, and things haven't gone brilliantly. Now, you know, everybody, every team, every player has a blip. So if you look at it in that way, you can say, well, hang on a sec, this guy's got to have a chance. Then others can say, well, no, because there are too many top players. It's an aging side, none of them performing. You know, is it the player's fault? Is it the manager's fault? Would you trust him with the kitty? You know, obviously there's the two guys above him as well, in Begiristain and Sariano. You know, are they doing the right job? Do they want to bring in their man? Guardiola's been linked forever. So again, yes, you're right in that, you know, you've got to have respect for the manager, and Manchester City haven't come out and said anything. But Pellegrini's been talking about his future, or trying to avoid it, but the questions have been there in every press conference. I think I've sat in front of him in every single one, and every time he's just said, I don't fear for my future. It's not a problem to me. It's nothing I can do anything about. All I do is concentrate on the next game. This is a guy that isn't going to lose too much sleep, you feel, whatever happens. You know, he's been a success, whatever should happen, should anything happen. It may well be that he is in charge next season, but of course, lots of speculation, lots of rumours.
Alan, you were saying you'd have him in a heartbeat if you were City.
Who, Klopp?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's nailed on for obviously Dominic knows a bit more than us being around the area, but I think it is, just judging by his statement today, Damien. I look at Pellegrini, and I think the key thing that Dominic said there is that he will not lose sleep either way, whether he stays or goes. I think he's gone. He looks like a broken man. The players are obviously not playing for him, and it would be no surprise to see Klopp going into Man City.
And not to go over everything that we've talked about Manchester City, you know, the last couple of Mondays, but it's more of a cultural thing. And, you know, is Klopp, as a young manager, would he be the type of guy that you'd put in and say, right, he can...
Yeah, well, I think
it.
Yeah, well, he's obviously a character who has huge confidence in himself and his own ability. So I think it needs someone of a high regard going in there, Damien, basically to ruffle a few feathers, because it looks to me that there's too many of them there going through the motions, and it's not acceptable really for a club of Man City size. Obviously, the situation upstairs, as Dominic said, with Soriano and Begiristain, it seems to me that they're calling a lot of the shots as well. So there'll have to be some sort of agreement broker there if Klopp does come in terms of, will he look to bring some players in with him? I would presume we'll all hear about the likes of Royce and Hummels maybe following, but others included, because the size of Man City and the wages they can offer, they're an attractive proposition for any player around the world. So it remains to be seen, really, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. When I heard this news today, I thought he's nailed on for City.
So, Dominic, what we have to wait then and see is, how is this going to play out if it is the case? Because the whole thing of, I've not spoken to a club, it's semantics, because his agent could be talking to Manchester City for the last 12 months, and you and I know how this works. So if he departs in the summer, you know, if he's sitting there waiting, they could move quite quickly on him.
Well, that's why it's got everybody's attention, isn't it? You know, he's got a contract till 2018. He's decided now to walk away. You know, they are 37 points off Munich. It's not going to happen for him. They were bottom, obviously, the Bundesliga. It took everyone by surprise how poor they've been. One thing that was interesting, and it doesn't, I suppose, make any great weight to the whole argument, but he made a point in today's press conference saying he's got 3 season tickets for next season for Dortmund. So whatever happens, he's not cutting ties. But of course, yeah, as you mentioned, we all know that, you know, should an offer, and the right offer, and he doesn't want a sabbatical, he's made that clear. And I think that obviously, really, reading between the lines, he feels that, you know, with the success that they've had, he's been a wee bit thwarted in the transfer market. He's lost key players, Sahin, Kagawa, Goetze, Lewandowski, now Hummels and Royce. Always been speculation about them maybe heading to England, one of the destinations. So, you know, I suppose maybe the manager's thinking, well, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. But again, there's so many questions need to be answered. But he's certainly got everyone thinking about this one. And of course, he's been linked with, you know, he's linked with Manchester City now, of course he is, but he's been linked with Manchester United in the past, and that was a move that some are saying that, you know, could have actually happened. Arsenal's also been one, but of course, you know, again, when managers like players, when they start doing the business, they get linked with everybody. I think it's just very, very interesting, Manchester City, you know, not just in terms of what might happen managerially wise, but also in terms of the playing staff and some of the players that you've both highlighted, you know, maybe not doing the business for the manager, whatever happens. So I think there will be a transitional period for Manchester City. There's going to be a lot of shifting around in the summer regardless. And it'll be interesting in the press conference on Friday, because we'll sit in front of Manuel Pellegrini once more. And again, those questions are going to be raised in terms of that he's got to prepare his side for West Ham lunchtime on Sunday, but you know, about that future. And I'm sure there'll be the wry smile again and him saying, this doesn't concern me, I'm preparing the side for West Ham, and all talk of the future is nothing, anything I can do anything about.
I'm just checking here in advance of him coming to United, to City if he does. I've just checked Manchester Airport, there are no direct flights to Dortmund for him to use those season tickets, but they do fly from Gatwick for £24 sterling each way. So there you go, he can use those tickets.
Well, yeah. I'm sure he can sort himself out with a private jet, you know, if his need is that great. But yeah. I wouldn't read too much into those season tickets.
Dominic, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
All the best, fellas.
Dominic McGuinness joining us there from Manchester. We live in interesting times. Who'd want to be? I was going to say, who'd want to be a manager? But then you think about it. Like, if I got the Man City job for a week and got sacked, I'd clear my mortgage and your mortgage in one go.
And everyone else's mortgage as well.
I've seen your house. Like, that's a big mortgage. We're back in a minute.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
And you're welcome back to the programme. We've been telling you all week across the station that 2FM is the home of the 10k giveaway. We've rescinded your entry, Alan Colley.
We have.
What would you do with 10,000 euro?
What would I do?
Yeah.
I'd go on a big long holiday.
I'd be delighted to give you 10k to go on a big long holiday. you could maybe take a break from your mortgage, you could upgrade your car, you could get out of the country altogether, but it will only take you a text. One of you listening. One of you could win 10,000 euro by 7 o'clock this Friday evening here on 2FM. You must be free to take a call from Colm Hayes live on Drive By this Friday to be in with your chance to win the cash. All you have to do is answer today's 10k question. Tell us which Irish singer had a hit with Take Me to Church. Was it Hozier or was it Ronan Keating? Hozier or Ronan Keating? To be with your chance to win 10k, text the word cash, followed by your answer and name to 57111. Entries cost €1 or £1 sterling. You must be over 18 to enter. Full details, terms and conditions are on our website. Lines will close at 6:45 on Friday, April 13th. Colin will be calling the winner live during drive-by. And as mentioned, it's like the Late Late Show. You must be available to take the call. So if you're going out for a couple of scoops after work on Friday, imagine, don't stick the phone in the handbag. Yeah. Don't stick it in the, leave it in the toilet.
I often see this happening. Imagine being the person that misses the call and you come home and see the phone.
Yeah.
You'd be devastated.
And if you've entered and you work or live somewhere that has really brutal signal, will you make sure for like 10 minutes that you stand in the corner of the kitchen, even if you get up on a stool that has signal? Anyway, we're going to chat rugby next. So much focus on the programme this week, or so much focus on rugby, I should say, has been on Leinster. It would appear out of the running for the playoffs in the Guinness Pro 12. They've got to go to Marseille on Sunday to face back-to-back European champions Toulon in the European Rugby Champions Cup semi-finals, and we will chat much greater detail about that match tomorrow and Friday on the programme. But let's get a view on the French champions, and who better to speak to than a man who plied his trade for Toulon, former English international Tom May, who played there between 2009 and 2011. It's been interesting, some of the criticism, albeit they're sitting on top of the top 14 and setting the world on fire in France, that this is a Toulon team that are ageing, a team that are in decline, a team that are probably not been exploited by a French team the way they could be by other teams. In your view, are Leinster, despite all that, still going to face the best team in Europe this weekend?
Well, potentially, and the fact that they're previous champions, you would think so, but Toulon, I don't think, are firing on all cylinders at the moment, so potentially for Leinster, it's a good time for them to be playing them. It's going to be tough in Marseille, but, you know, I think Leinster have what it takes to to pull it out of the bag. And you know, on an occasion like this, you wouldn't think that they would fancy that challenge. Mm.
And from a player's perspective, Leinster have had to endure a week of people calling their character into question, calling, you know, the fact that are they a team in decline, and that hurts within a dressing room. So the situation is there for an ideal Leinster fight back.
Yeah, and you know, if no one's giving you a chance, then what better challenge is there within professional sport? You know, it's a great place for them to go and play in Marseille for the Velodrome, is that'll be bouncing on the weekend. And you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the likes of Ian Madigan coming up against Matt Gitto potentially. You know, we normally see so many big centres. Seeing two ball players really excites me, and Sunday's going to shape up to be a fantastic game, I think.
Where is there a weakness for Leinster to attack in Toulon?
I think you'd have to look at, well, he's a potential strength, but I think one of the weaknesses is Bastereau. He's obviously not in the greatest of shape. A massive ball carrier, but his outside shoulder is something that can be exposed. I think Elliot Daly did a great job for them, against Toulon a couple of weeks ago, and I think Leinster will try and expose that again, expose that width, and really try and stretch Toulon. Yeah, they're fine coming off when they've got loads of line speed, but let's try and move the ball around and really find where Toulon might be weak. And I think that Bastereau's outside shoulder and those wider areas are somewhere that Leinster can get some real change. Mm.
Just in terms of Toulon, and obviously you were there in the early days of the most recent revolution and the money that's gone into the club, it's resulted in a culture almost of invincibility, and there must be no team goes to play, be it at the Félix Mayol or be it in Marseille, who goes in as favourites. So from a psychological point of view, how do you counteract that?
I think you've just got to take it as, yeah, it's a massive challenge. And like I just said before, you know, people are writing you off. So what better way to prove people wrong? I think French rugby is one of those leagues where a lot of teams might not fancy that trip down to Mayol, so potentially might send down a second team or the likes. But Leinster certainly won't do that. And I don't think they'll be frightened by what awaits them on Sunday, almost probably the other way around, actually excited by the opportunity that lies ahead.
When you reflect on your career, how fondly do you look back on those days in France?
Oh, it was amazing, you know, and a fantastic opportunity to go from somewhere like Newcastle, where it's not warm for most of the year and blowing a gale, down to living in the Mediterranean. It was an opportunity that I didn't want to, and I didn't want to turn down. And I certainly, you know, I look back on those 2 years and you know, with so many experiences. Obviously, the experience you gain from on the rugby field, but living a different life, learning about a new culture, it's something to take in. And it's a, you know, it's brilliant that so many players are managing to do that now.
But it's a much bigger decision now for an English player, isn't it? Because the policy of not selecting players who are abroad, that you're effectively, you know, it was said about Irish rugby for a long time, you're effectively bidding farewell to your international career if you look to pursue that opportunity.
Yeah, and I can understand that. You know, the Premiership in England is a fantastic competition, and the English international side want to protect that and their international players. So I can understand that idea, but when you see guys like Nick Abenden and Stefan Armitage playing so well, with a World Cup just around the corner, that's possibly one ruling that might be slightly to the detriment of the England side. I think someone like Stefan Armitage would add a huge amount to that England team. But you can understand why they've done it, the ideas behind it.
Yeah, and I suppose the challenge for all of us, be it the IRFU, be it the RFU or the clubs in the Premiership, is that you just need to find a way of making it more attractive, be it financially or be it in terms of the whole package, to try and entice players to stay within your system.
Yeah, exactly. But how difficult is that when you see the salaries that some of these players are being offered? You know, you can't. Professional rugby and professional sport is a short career. Mm. You can understand why these players are heading over to France to pick up a perhaps bigger paycheck and to look after their future. You know, they only get one shot, and from some of the things that people are saying about certain players, I think, you know, they have to sometimes see it from a different perspective. You know, it's an opportunity, as I said you know, when it came around for me, I certainly couldn't turn that down. So I wouldn't sort of have a go at anyone for taking that choice.
And then just to finish, Toulon, obviously, they get a fair bit of abuse or criticism that it's all built on money. That do they necessarily get as much respect for the team that they've managed to put together, the quality of the rugby they play, and maybe the cohesive unit? Because it would appear from the outside in, a remarkably happy camp that play rugby together.
Yeah, and I think when I first went, there was that sort of said week in, week out, you know, there's a load of mercenaries arrived on the south coast to pick up their paycheck. But actually, the people that went there, the people that were chosen by Philippe Saint-André, were still wanting to be, they were of the mindset that they're always going to be competitive as individuals. And I think that's something that Philippe was trying to develop at that time, a professionalism within the club that's allowed them to really kick on. And you see the guys that are arriving there now with the potential names for next season as well, and you can see that, yeah, all right, there's some big money floating around, but these guys aren't going. That, you know, you could say that Matt Gitto is playing now some of the best rugby of his whole career. You know, if Australia changed that ruling on their international side, you know, why wouldn't we see him playing? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think those players, yes, they go there for the financial reasons, for the lifestyle, but also they've got a massive competitive desire within every single one of those players that makes them the team they are.
Very briefly, if you would, who's going to contest the final, Leinster or Toulon?
Obviously, this going out on an Irish radio station.
I know, don't worry, we'll let you be completely impartial. You can be honest with us, you know?
I think, I actually think it'll be Toulon on the weekend. I think they've just got a bit too much in the tank on Leinster. I think it'll be a lot closer than probably people will give Leinster credit for, but I think we'll probably see Leinster lose in Marseille and Toulon go on to play Clermont in the final.
I admire your honesty on Irish national radio.
And now I can run away.
There you go, yeah. You won't be getting many points again this next time you're in Temple Bar. Tom, great pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for your time. Enjoy the game.
Thank you very much.
So there you go now. If you ever meet Tom May around Temple Bar, if you're wandering out around your palatial villa out in North County Dublin, you know, you remind him of the time he said that.
Big Tom.
Yeah, Big
Tom. I'd sort him, I'd say.
Would you?
Yeah, I'd sort Big Tom.
Do you ever get into a real, like, proper digging match now on the field of play? I don't ever remember you getting into anything too dirty.
No, I threw a few handbags down in Cove one night, and literally they were handbags.
Yeah.
This fella kicked me. Colin O'Brien. Remember Colin O'Brien used to play with Cork?
Yeah.
And I know Colin
is this
well.
Allegedly now? Are we going to end up in the High Court?
No. Colin, yeah. He clipped me from behind and I didn't take too kindly to it.
You clipped a few fellas yourself over the years.
No, this was Colin being a clever fox that he is.
Sure.
Clipped me and I got up and threw a few handbags and got sent. First time to be sent off or something like that.
Which means there were more than one time. If you say, if it was the only time, you'd have said it was the only time.
No, because I got sent off for mouthing before.
Seriously? Alan Cawley sent off for mouthing. Anyway, we're going to stay with rugby and an area that, if we're very honest, I think very few people have a proper understanding of. The scrum, and it becomes one of those frustrating aspects of the modern game, resets, inconsistencies on how referees officiate them. We're going to chat about that and much more. We'll talk to Shane Byrne in just a moment. But first, delighted to say we're joined from Athlone by former Connacht Wasps, Bristol Harlequins prop, and a man who did great work with the Irish women's team in recent years and a big part of their Grand Slam success, Peter Bracken. Peter, how are you?
Good, Damien.
Good to talk to you. You've been doing a bit of work on the scrum in recent years, and you have concerns over how it's officiated and perhaps the knowledge officials have of the scrum.
Yes. I have noticed recently, watching rugby, and especially over the Six Nations, that I found that a lot of penalties in the scrum that were being given, they were being given incorrectly, given to the wrong team. Like, I've no actual stats on it. It's just from a fan and a rugby geek or a scrum geek watching the game that there's in around 50% of the penalties that are given incorrectly. And I just think it needs to be improved.
Mm. Now, does that come down to simple, in your opinion, the knowledge officials have of the scrum, or what is it? What are we looking at?
Well, you know, it's an extremely technical side of the game. And it's very difficult for a referee to be able to be an expert in the scrum and be an expert in the breakdown, an expert in every area of the game. I don't think a lot of not many referees that are playing played in the front row, and I think it's very difficult to expect a referee to know the absolute ins and outs of a scrummaging. And lots of times scrums go down, and sometimes it's for no apparent reason. Somebody maybe slipped, or someone actually made an infringement. But my concern is, yes, there are infringements being made, but half the time it goes to the wrong team. For example, guys standing up in a scrum or popping up in a scrum seems to be one that has been pulled quite a bit recently. Now, it's hard to expect a referee to know the difference between whether a loose head is popping his the opposition tight head prop, which is illegal, or the tight head, because he's under pressure, is just standing up out of the scrum, which looks like the loose head is popping the scrum. So unless you have in-depth knowledge of what's going on there, it's very hard to recognise the difference.
So in a situation like that, then, do we need to get into a world where referees are educated to, you know, the nth degree on the scrum, or do we, you know, like, how do you rectify this?
Well, you know, I think there's two ways you could go about it. How about having two scrum referees to come on the game, into the game, ref the scrum and come back off, whether that's the touch judges or somebody else. One or two people to come onto the pitch to help the referee for the couple of seconds after that game and come off. Now, it may be a radical idea. Obviously, we don't want rugby turning into American football where it's all stop-start and referees all over the place. But I think it's worth giving a go. You know, a scrum referee or two, come on, watch the scrum from either side of the scrum and officiate on it. I think that'll do two things. It'll make the players more aware that actually there are two experts here within a yard or two of me. I have to be squeaky clean or I'm going to get caught. And it just would ease the pressure off the referee, especially at the higher level of the game. And what not, you know, I don't think it's possible to do that at the lower levels of the game. But in professional rugby, when the stakes are high, big trophies, big money on the line, I think something along those lines is worth at least trialling. Then also, I'm part of the IRFU Elite Scrum Coaches Programme, and there's about 12 or 15 of us involved in that scrummaging, coaching the scrum and coaching potential future front rowers, international front rowers. So we haven't had much contact with the referees, whether that's our fault or there just hasn't been, seems to me, much collaboration. So maybe that's something both sides could we could come together as, we'd say, scrum experts or scrum gurus, or what some people might think, just guys that think they know what they're talking about, but don't really. But never mind.
I was going to say, it's like, I think Jamie Heaslip made the point before. Someone asked him about a scrum in a post-match interview, and he said, "Don't ask me. I'm at the back of it. I haven't got a clue what goes on up the front." But you know, that could be the reality. Let's get a secondary view. Delighted to say Shane Byrne joins us as well. Shane, how are you?
I'm good, and yourself?
Not too bad. Come here. A big one on this is the fact that this is, and it would appear, has become a problem issue at the elite level very quickly. That this wasn't something necessarily, from my memory, that you were having to contend with when you were hooking back in the day.
No, because the look, refereeing of the scrum has changed. They're looking at the scrum now and going, right, what's wrong with it? As opposed to, is this a vehicle to get the game back going again? And they're looking for all the little things that could possibly go wrong. Now, yes, the game has changed, but this all started from the rules that they brought in with the touch and the bind and all the different ones that they've had over the while, you know, that changed the scrum completely. And a lot of the times, front rows were able to sort it out themselves. Like, you know, a guy who might get done in the first scrum would work his way through it and keep being able to try different things and sort the scrum out himself. But where now a ref, if a guy gets done in the first scrum, the ref kind of has made his mind up, well then, this guy is going to get in trouble, he's going to be the weaker scrum right the way through the game, and he kind of favours the situation that it. But there's always a tell. Like, there's always, you know, I agree with what Brax is saying, not the first bit, because the reason he said was that it couldn't translate right down into the lower part of the game, and any rules that we change need to be able to work right the way into the amateur game. But the second bit, where there must be much more communication from the people who know what is going on in the scrum, and telling the refs that, look, you don't need to particularly get the whistle in your mouth at the first thing that happens. If the ball is moving out, let it go. But if this happens, if A happens or B happens, that's a prop getting on top of the other prop.
But on that, right, okay, we're all part of the rugby family. You know, it's very easy for us to focus, Shane, on the referees, and it need for it to be a referee-driven issue in rectifying it. But how much of it comes down to the players? Because the players presumably know that a referee is looking at binding, they're looking at footwork, they're looking at the angles that they go in.
Yeah.
In the elite game, the referee is analysed pre-match as much as anyone else. So if you get pinged first off, like, you go back to Wayne Barnes for Ireland against Wales, should the Irish players themselves not have known from the off, from whatever conversation happens beforehand, this is how we need to behave ourselves today?
Well, the problem with Mr. Barnes is that, like, he like I said at the start, he takes an impression of a scrum and then runs with it. Unfortunately, in the Welsh game, he made a wrong decision and then kept the wrong decision. So yes, potentially you should say that the players on the pitch should have adjusted. But what you had there was a fact that on the Ireland side of the scrum, there was almost parity met. There was nobody going to push anybody around the place. But on the Ireland loose head side of the scrum with Keane Healy, we had the dominance. So therefore, when all eight push, if the tight head doesn't move, the loose head is going to move, the scrum wheels round, the ref thinks it's a wheel, which is incorrect, and gives the penalty against Ireland. That's the problem, is that he should know that if he's looking at the scrum and looking at the tight head, if the tight head's in a ding-dong mattle, he's not going to move anywhere. Mm. And if the loose head is on top, you shouldn't penalise him for pushing.
Okay. Peter, just on it, we look at it. I think that the stats for the most recent quarterfinals in Europe, you were down around a 25-30% completion rate in terms of scrums. So is it a curse particularly on the elite game rather than the club game? And does that maybe bring in a level of questioning the feedback, because, you know, I'm not saying you're into social rugby, but you have a greater mechanism potentially in the AIL or club rugby to talk to a referee after the match to find out where things went wrong than you necessarily do on match day at the elite level?
Well, absolutely, and I suppose it's a responsibility of both sides, the players and the referees. It's an interesting point, because I was just talking to Alan Lewis, a former international referee, only a couple of weeks ago, and he said he learned most of his scrum knowledge, or what he learned was from talking to players after games. Like, he would say himself, at one stage, he didn't know the difference, psychologically or otherwise, what the difference in a prop's head or a tactical difference between a scrum on the 5 metre line, 5 metres from the opposition line, and a scrum in midfield, until he went and actually found out and asked players. And, you know, he constantly was talking to players after games, trying to improve his knowledge of the game and his refereeing of the scrum. And it's not done enough.
We'll see where it goes from here, lads. We're not going to sort it out between ourselves this evening, but I'm sure we'll chat about it again in the future. Good to talk to you both. Thanks indeed. Peter Bracken joining us there from Athlone, and Shane Byrne joining us on the phone. 51552 at GameOn2FM for your texts. We are going to talk about funding in sport, particularly at grassroots level after a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
And you're very welcome back to Game On. This is Damien O'Mara. The government today announced the allocation of €7.4 million in funding for grassroots sports through the Irish Sports Council. The GAA will receive €2.4 million, the IRFU €2.36 million, and the FAI €2.7 million. Let's get some insight on the importance of that allocation at grassroots level. Paul Caffrey served as Dublin manager between 2004 and 2008. Those who follow Gaelic games will know that he's a Garda in Dublin city centre working with young people, so he's well placed to chat about the role of sport across all sports and the need for resources at grassroots level. Regardless of the sport, the fact that money like this and funding like this has been maintained and put into development and getting kids participating, it's really to be well received.
Yeah, it's fantastic news for sport in general. You know, I'm a juvenile liaison officer working in the inner city, and you know, the more kids that we get involved in sport, and this money will trickle down to, you know, through the GA, rugby, soccer, there'll be huge benefits for all children around the country, and it's a great day.
Do people give full understanding or full respect to the power that sport can have in a situation like that? You know, I think the FAI, for example, a lot of the money that they will receive will go into the midnight leagues in disadvantaged areas or high crime rate areas. That sport has great power to unite and to maybe keep people on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, absolutely, and I would see it on a daily basis. You know, even in the inner city, you know, soccer is huge, and them midnight leagues have been a huge advantage, and they've been very popular for the last couple of seasons that the FAI have ran, and keeping kids away from crime on Friday nights, and that whole prospect. And, you know, boxing is another sport that's hugely popular in the inner city, and, you know, while GA hasn't really kicked in, I know Scully Connell, for example, are making big efforts in terms of trying to tag some of the kids from the inner city and keep them involved. And obviously money makes these things work. And you know, in Dublin GA, the number of coaches that are on the ground is huge at the moment. And like, these are all paid coaches now that are paid by the county board. So it's huge benefit.
And to look at the numbers, last year, 770,000 people taking part in various programmes delivered by the GAA, the IRFU and the FAI. And like that's phenomenal when you think of the impact that any form of exercise or sporting activity will have in a country where so many people are concerned, and rightly so, about obesity and health issues.
Yeah, and look, the way the schools program has gone, there's less time being devoted for PE in schools, and it's become a less part of the curriculum. And anything that's been done outside of school hours that involves kids participating in sport can only be good for the country as a whole.
Mm. And overall, I suppose, as well as that, there's bound to be a little bit of competition between the sports, because the earlier you get people and can harness that love within them, the more chance you have of them, you know, sticking with your sport for their career or their interest.
Yeah, well, look, we all came up through a system where whatever school you went to, that was the sport that you played. You know, nowadays, all schools are trying to diversify and take in as many sports as possible, but there's not as many volunteers on the ground anymore, and time is more precious with people for the last number of years. So it is a battle to win the wills and to win the time to put into kids, and this is all good news today.
And you'd see it in your role with your club away from your profession. 6.3% growth in kids participating in GAA club nurseries in Dublin alone in 2014. 89,000 people taking part in the GAA Cool Camp. So from a GAA perspective, they are using the money really, really well.
Yeah, and look, Nafine is my GA club up in Glasnevin, and you know, I'm back in charge of the senior football team, but I would be up there on Saturday mornings, and we visited our nursery there a couple of weeks ago, and the numbers that are up there are quite incredible at the moment. And you know, I had the pleasure of visiting Cool Camps over the years, and to think that, you know, all these kids are getting involved and then hopefully staying involved in sport, it's incredible to think that you know, this is the way forward, and hopefully this will be a repeat investments in the years to come.
Yeah, and I see it myself, like Clontarf would be my club. I see it with, you know, Jack McCaffrey, what it means for kids to see Jack and other members of the Dublin panel come to the Cool Camps, and you'd have seen that yourself, that, you know, you're quite literally inspiring the next generation of Dublin footballers in your case.
Yeah, and like, the story is that, like, the Jack McCaffreys and the Johnny Coopers and Tom Brady's, they all came through the nurseries, whether it be Nafina or Clontarf, and this is where the next generation of GA stars are going to come from. And, you know, up in Nafina, we take them in from 5 years of age. We nurture them and start coaching them and get them involved in having fun games and a bit of exercise on a Saturday morning. And you know, that's what people are looking for, and that's what the clubs are providing.
And the most important thing, like, you know, we've talked for the last minute or two about GAA, but any sport, be it soccer, rugby, you know, Gaelic games, if you can just get people involved, that's what we should be trying to do with our young people, you know, to finish.
Yeah, you know, I'm a great believer that it doesn't matter what sport a child gets involved in, If you can nurture that and encourage them and make them feel good about themselves, well, you're doing a great day's work.
It's a somber day for yourself and for a lot of people in the GAA community in Dublin and indeed across the country. Such was the reach of Dave Billings. And I suppose maybe it's somewhat ironic that that funding like this comes out on a day that a man that would have been so heavily involved in deploying it has passed on tragically.
Yeah, you know, sad day for everybody involved in the GAA in Dublin. He was a great St. Vincent's man, Marino. He'd done fantastic work out in UCD the last number of years, and a great friend of mine, Davy Billings, passed away early this morning, age 63. But, you know, everybody has a story about Davy Billings. He touched so many people's lives, and you know, our sympathies go out to Annette and his four kids. It's a very sad day in Dublin, and an awful lot of people will be touched by the news that Davy has suddenly passed away.
Yeah, and indeed, like it spans the country, because anyone who came to college and, you know, got the number 10 bus across to UCD, regardless of what county you were from, he touched so many people, and he was involved in the, you know, the university career of, we could be here all day listing off inter-county hurlers and footballers that he would have come in contact with.
Yeah, and already, you know, the text that I've received from people in Cork and people in Westmeath and people in, all over the country, Davy didn't discriminate when it came to helping out people. And you know, the number of kids that he helped out in UCD, both on and off the pitch, is innumerable. He's left a great legacy behind him, and he'll be sorely missed by an awful lot of people.
Yeah, but so fondly remembered, which is probably the most important thing, and that the legacy will live on. Pillar, appreciate you taking the time to have a chat with us on the day that's in it. Many thanks for your time.
All right, cheers.
Paul Caffrey chatting to us there. You crossed paths with Dave Billings in UCD.
Well, yeah, kind of. When we were there for the football, the soccer, that is, obviously the Gaelic teams, and he was looking after all the different Gaelic teams, but he wasn't too fond of us soccer fellas going
sure
on his Gaelic pitches.
He was probably. I mean, you were desecrating the soccer pitch, the GAA pitches. That's a different story.
We had a better team than them.
Yeah, whatever.
But,
right.
Dave, yeah, he was obviously well thought of.
We have to leave it there. We'll come back to the scrum texts on the programme tomorrow night. Hopefully, we'll have our weekly chat with Ronan and Bernard looking ahead to Toulon against Leinster. Owen McDermott is on the way. Thanks to JJ Hartigan, producer Andrew O'Connor. Thank you, Alan Cawley.
Pleasure, Damien.
From Damien O'Mara till tomorrow at 7. Good night.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.